6. Johnny looked toward the Orplane landing field beyond the short road. Deserted. The Scot carrying radio equipment answered his beckoning. The covering scrap of a tumbling rain. Johnny checked the set. Working. He flipped to planetary pilot band and picked up the mic. "Flight to Nairobi standing by," said Johnny. It would sound like routine pilot traffic, but a code had been prearranged with the two ships they had left near the power plant. Nairobi meant fly into our beacon, and standing by meant don't come in shooting, but be alert. Donald Dean's voice crackled back.
"All passengers aboard."
They were on their way. Johnny took the mine radio off his belt and turned it to constant bleep, which was used by miners when trapped or caught in a cave-in. It would act as a radio beacon for the planes. He stabbed a finger at 3 of his force. As the men passed, he handed one of them the mine radio to put in a tree at the field. Assault rifles held low, running wide of the compound, pausing to give one another cover, they raced toward the landing field. Shortly, one of them, seen as a blur through the dull curtains of rain, but brighter out there on the field edge, raised a hand in an all-clear. They would give the plane's landing cover as they came in. Johnny slung the blast rifle over his shoulder and hobbled across the compound perimeter, his cane not sinking so deep on this more traveled ground. He could hear pumps going further south. That would be where the mine workings were. He saw that a branch of the power cables they had used to trace this place turned off halfway up the road to the field. He followed it. A squat hut made of stone sat there in the trees, festooned with insulators and surrounded by pipes. He recognized it as a fuel and ammunition manufacturing unit. Ha, they had one at this branch mine, probably to utilize all the excess power available from the hydroelectric plant. The ground around it was roughed up with recent foot and flatbed traffic. The door was ajar. He gave it a push with his cane. What a jumble. Fuel and ammunition canisters were usually stacked neatly on racks in these places. Side bins usually contained the various minerals used in concocting the contents of the canisters. A recent flurry of activity had left minerals spilled on the floor and damaged unusable canisters underfoot. This place had been very busy very recently. He knew it took a bit of time to stir up and charge the brews that became fuel and ammunition and seal them into canisters. Had they worked here flat out for days? A week? He made his way over to the exit road that must go to the main mine site, using a shortcut between the two roads. He looked at the brush on both sides of the exit road. Ordinarily, his educated eye would have been able to track this easily, but the pouring rain made it more difficult. He bent, examining some twigs broken from the underbrush that bordered the road. Some breaks, the ones that pointed toward the compound, must be several days old. Others, very fresh, still leaking sap, were broken in the direction of the main mine site up near a lake that old man maps said had been called Lake Victoria. A convoy had come in here many days, weeks ago, and had gone out hours ago. A big convoy. He glanced up the exit road, half expecting to see trucks or tanks coming down it, back to the compound. Their tactical situation was not ideal. They had a small force of Brigantes holding out in the woods back of them. Somewhere near or far, there must be the better part of 1,000 Brigantes. And up this road, he looked at the traces of the ground drives, there were a very large number of cyclo vehicles. Or flatbeds? Tanks? He heard their planes now. That sound wouldn't matter after all the uproar of this recent skirmish, and any convoy on that road wouldn't hear anything above their own motor drives. The vast canopy of treetops that made this place a twilight not only prevented anyone from looking down at the exit road and seeing anything on it, but also prevented anyone on it from seeing up. A poor tactical situation. They could not fight a convoy, probably escorted with tanks, in this water-saturated, hemmed-in forest. Their planes were of no use to them. He made his way over to the landing field. Sky. Not much sky, but enough to get ore freighters up and down through. Leaking sky, but sky. He hadn't seen any sky in 3 days. The soldiers were in the trees covering the field. The mine radio bleeper was set in a 15-inch diameter vine that coiled like a huge snake up a tall tree. Maybe this field had once been bigger, but the jungle and the trees had encroached deeply. The big marine attack battle plane wound down from directly overhead, letting the smaller battle plane cover it from above as was proper. Then the plane mushroomed a puddle of field water into a geyser and came to a halt. It was Dunnell Dean. He swung the door open and sat there grinning, glad to see Johnny. Robert the Fox came rushing up. The side door of the big plane swung open, and the officer of the remaining part of their force looked questioningly. Robert waved him to sit tight, no emergency, and got into the smaller battle plane with Johnny and Dunnell Dean. Johnny was rapidly filling Dunnell Dean in on the events. "There's a convoy on that road headed for the main mine site," concluded Johnny. "I think they came down here for fuel and ammunition, and then went back."
"Ah," said Dunnell Dean. "That explains it."
Typical Dunnell Dean, he had not been sitting quietly waiting for their call. He could get that, he said, back at the dam or way upstairs. So he'd left the big attack plane at the dam and on radio standby so they could recall him, and he'd been keeping the main mine site, up at what they used to call Lake Albert, under surveillance by going way up and following normal traffic routes. His instruments and view screens could penetrate rain and cloud, even though they couldn't see a thing through the canopy of trees. The main mine site, he recalled, had been knocked out on day 92 by a pilot.
McArdle?
Yes, McArdle. And he'd had a bit of trouble. The Cyclos had attempted to loft 2 battle planes, and McArdle had nailed them right at the hangar launch door, blocking it. He'd blown their power lines to bits and knocked out huge breathe gas and fuel and ammunition dumps. The Cyclos had gotten 2 batteries of anti-aircraft into operation, and he'd had to knock those out. This was the fight where the co-pilot had been wounded, if Johnny and Sir Robert recalled. A very fighting mine site. Anyway, Dunnell Dean went on his overflights from 100,000 feet up during the last 3 days, he hadn't found any current movement in the place, but, he showed them the pictures he'd gotten from his screens, those apes had cleared away the hangar door, that's it there, and look over here, see? Those shadows under the trees at the edge of their field, no, over there, 10 battle planes on standby.
"Nobody ever came back to mop up that mine site," he concluded, "and those gorillas have been busy."
Johnny looked at the several pictures. One had been taken with a lower sun. He examined the profiles of the planes half hidden under the trees. He looked at Dunnell Dean.
"Yes," said Dunnell Dean, "just like you described the one you put on the gas throne. Mark 32, low-flying ground strafers, heavy, heavily armored. Not much range, but they can carry extra fuel cartridges."
"Those Cyclos," said Johnny, "are not setting up to defend their mine site. They're probably desperate for breathe gas. They had their fuel blown up. See the dolly tracks in the grass in front of those Mark 32s? They were dollied there, not flown there." He pointed to the hut half seen through the trees. "They've been over there for days manufacturing fuel and ammunition like mad. They used what fuel they could scrape up to get that convoy here. They grabbed all the breathe gas, I'm sure. And they're on their way back."
"The only other big supply of breathe gas," said Robert the Fox, "is over at the Central Compound in America. That's where they're headed."
"With those 10 Mark 32s, they could turn this whole war around the other way," said Johnny. He opened a map, water still dripping off him and onto it, and traced out the exit road. He found it left the forest, ran across a plain, and into a long ravine that was open to the sky. The road went on toward Lake Albert, but there was a flat place as it left the ravine. He looked at some pictures Donald Dean had taken. "We've got a battle coming up," said Johnny. He measured distances and turned to Sir Robert. "It will take them a day and a half to reach this spot. 2 days to the main compound, since that road is awfully bad. Meanwhile, we have to take care of the main force of Brigantes. Pack Colonel Ivan, 4 raiders, and a mortar into this place. Tell him he's got to hold that pass until relieved. And you, Donald Dean, stand by up there to make sure that convoy doesn't get through. Remember, we're only after live cyclos."
"We're after stopping a counterattack on the Denver area," said Sir Robert.
Thor had gone down to put in an appearance at the Mountains of the Moon as Johnny. He was a fair rider and would put on a bit of a show for them and say hello. He was scheduled to visit another tribe south of there. It was a bit far for recall, and it would mess up their plans to expose where Johnny really was.
"I'm sorry you've only got one battle plane," said Johnny.
Donald Dean smiled happily.
"But there is only one battle, Johnny lad."
Robert the Fox was rapping out orders, and very shortly Colonel Ivan and 4 soldiers struggled up through the rain carrying a bazooka and a blast mortar and other equipment. They'd forgotten about their coordinator to translate for them, and it was a very tight fit indeed to get all this into the battle plane. Sir Robert briefed Colonel Ivan. He smiled cheerfully. Ambushes and passes of the Hindu Kush were much more complicated. "Have no fear, Marshal Johnny and War Chief Robert. That pass would be held. Live cyclos? Well, not quite as satisfactory, but have no fear. The valiant Red Army would perform." The battle plane soared up, 7 men and 1 battle plane to stop a convoy of dozens of cyclos and battle tanks. Donald Dean waved down at them through the rain and was gone.